In our daily lives, we often take for granted the level of protection and security we enjoy that is provided by our local police department. But during a time of calamity that could be either short or long term, picking up the phone to dial 911 may not be an option. Do you have the proper tools to provide security for you and your family if no one can come to help? First, I want to thank Range 6 for providing firearm consultation for this video. Check out range6.com online for firearms, training, and accessories. I'm going to break this video down into three parts. Number one, I'll talk about the criteria I use for deciding these five firearms in my top five list. I encourage you to listen to this section and not skip ahead to my top firearms because it will help you understand a great deal more why I choose the options I did and will help you when you're deciding on what firearms you should get. Number two, my personal top five prepper firearm selections. And number three, a brief discussion regarding the role of firearms in prepping as well as comments regarding training. So let's begin. The criteria I use when deciding which top firearms made it to my list are the following. Number one, reliability. Does this firearm have a proven track record? You'll notice in my list that many of the firearms are used around the world by both military and law enforcement and have a long history in service and a proven track record. Number two, availability. Is this a common firearm? Now, this is important for getting parts. In a prolonged grid-down scenario, if you need parts and you have a firearm that is rare, getting parts or ammo may be difficult. Also, finding aftermarket accessories and parts is even easier if you have a common firearm. Also, is the ammunition that it uses, is it common? This makes finding the ammunition much easier to acquire if it's a common round. Often when a firearm is common and plentiful, it helps drive down the price, which is our next point. Number three, affordability. Is this firearm reasonably priced? Now, this is a bit relative. Firearms in general are not cheap, but many of these firearms we're discussing are a little lower on the price range compared to many options, which can get a lot more expensive. For some of the firearms we'll discuss, I'll mention some more affordable alternatives for you to consider. And number four, capability. Do you have training or experience with this firearm? I've heard it said instead of buying a $2,300 rifle, instead buy an $800 firearm and get $1,500 worth of training. I believe that. Training is critical should you be in a stressful situation. It's easy to go to the range and just plink around, but if you're in a life or death situation and you have a malfunction or gun jam, would you even know how to work through the issue? So without further ado, let's jump into my top five prepper firearms. I'm going to start with number five and work down to my top pick. While working through each of these, I'll try to give you a little background, why I personally chose them, and on a few of these firearms, we'll discuss some more affordable alternatives. So here's number five on my list, a 22 caliber firearm. 22 caliber firearms are a popular choice among many preppers due to their relative affordability, low cost of ammunition, and the ability to take down small game, as well as a carrying capacity. 1,000 rounds of 22 caliber can easily be packed. Now, the 22 caliber firearm that often comes up is the Ruger 10/22, and it will set you back around $250. There's over about 5 million of these in circulation. They've been around in production since about 1964. The rifle is ideal for young or inexperienced shooters and just plinking around. It's built with a very simple construction, meaning that the average person can easily replace any part in the gun with nothing more than a screwdriver, a hex key, and some simple punches. If it's the only option you have, it can be used as a self-defense rifle. With a well-placed shot, it could get the job done. While people may complain that the 22 caliber isn't high-powered enough to be a true self-defense weapon, if you take a shot to the dome with one of these, it might change your mind. So what are some affordable alternatives? A pellet gun is a pretty solid, affordable alternative. They're relatively inexpensive. You don't have to have a license to get one. I did a video on a particular pellet gun a while back. I'll provide a link in the description below and you can check out that a little more. Number four on my list is a long rifle. If you need to reach out long distances or take down a small game, this is a great option. You can get larger caliber either in bolt action or semi-automatic. And I went with the 308 because it's a very common round and it has great long distance capabilities and knockdown power. These rounds enable a trained marksman to reach out to distances in excess of 1,000 yards. While a 1,000 yard shot may not be easy to do, it's possible with the correct training. And you also have the advantage of accuracy with this setup. For this option, I went with the Remington 700, which is chambered in a 308. The Remington 700 is a popular firearm used among police departments and is a foundation for military snipers and defensive marksman rifles. While these have a higher recoil, these tools are really more designed for reaching out than close quarter engagements. So I just picked up this Remington 700, and obviously as you can see it doesn't have an optic yet, but currently I've got my eye on the Vortex HST 6x24, which comes in at about around $650. Something I gotta save up for. It'll be a while. So, what are some cheap alternatives? For those looking for a solid long-range rifle and a cheap, It's really hard to beat the Mosin Nagant. I used to have one of these for years, and they're a lot of fun. They were used during World War II in the battlefield, and they have a very, very long history, and in some places they're actually still used in countries like Afghanistan. They're pretty rugged. They're not exactly the best firearm in the world. The quality is pretty low on the one I had, but coming in around $100 to $150, it's kind of hard to beat those. Number three on my list is a shotgun. These firearms are often used in close quarter engagements, but they can print 3-inch groups at 100 meters with slugs and are often touted as a great home defense firearm and are devastatingly powerful. They're a bit more forgiving than a standard rifle in relation to hitting a target, and with the right ammunition, you can avoid over-penetration in your walls whenever you're shooting in your home. In addition, these can also be used for hunting. The two top strengths of the shotgun are power and versatility. There's different loads that you can use, like birdshot or buckshot and slugs, and these are all great hunting and defense loads. For example, modern self-defense shot could be compared to sending multiple 9mm bullets at once with 1600 feet per second behind them, and that's pretty good stuff right there. Now, I went with the Remington 870 12 gauge. Again, this is a model that has a long history dating back to the 50s with over 10 million in production since that time. In addition, these rifles have proven their effectiveness and reliability and are used by both the military and police around the world. These are extremely effective in stopping hostile targets, and you can feed them a variety of types of 12-gauge ammunition. The 12-gauge round is very common and easy to purchase, which makes it especially popular in the prepping community. Most have heard of the 12-gauge shotgun, but the 20-gauge shotgun can be very effective in stopping a would-be assailant as well, and is great for someone with a smaller or lighter frame. So what are some cheap alternatives? Well, the one that I often see when I'm doing research on 12-gauges is the Maverick 88. Might want to check it out. I'll provide a link in the description below if you want to watch some reviews on that one. Number two on my list is a handgun. Handguns come in two primary flavors, revolvers and semi-automatic, and both have their pros and cons. I personally decided to go with a semi-automatic because it gives me more carrying capacity and I can reload a lot faster with a magazine, which enables me to get back on target quickly after reloading. In addition, there's less felt recoil combined with generally larger grips and no heavy double action trigger pull, which for self-defense firearms is all pluses to get multiple rounds on target quickly. One of the biggest advantages a handgun offers is that it can be carried on your person at all times. It's easy to conceal and easy to maneuver in tight spaces, which is great if you live in an urban environment. Now, before purchasing a handgun, be sure to try out several different models to make sure they all fit correctly in your hand. Many firearm ranges will allow you to rent a handgun, and finding the one that fits correctly for you is important. I personally went with a Glock 19. With its drop-dead simplicity and ability to go bang whenever you pull the trigger, makes it a very popular go-to for law enforcement and some militaries. It requires little training to become proficient with this pistol, and it has the advantage of being very popular, making it easy to get parts and accessories. Due to its popularity and being so common, gun shops typically have to compete with each other, driving down the prices on these firearms. This particular pistol I ended up going with is the Glock 19. It uses the 9mm round, which is very common, and you'll hear a lot of arguments online about which is the best ammunition, you know, 9mm, 40 cal, or 45. While this video will not go into all the differences between these different rounds, the 9mm round is manageable to shoot and very effective. I put a lot of rounds through this particular platform and have had to learn how to deal with malfunctions along with learning how to reload it quickly. Do I think it's the best option out there for everyone? No, not necessarily, but the grip is a little larger than I would like, making changing a magazine quickly a little difficult, as my thumb can't reach around the mag release without a little manipulation, but I found workarounds. Plus, I live in California and our options for pistols are being reduced every year, so I'm fortunate this time to at least have this option. A Glock will usually set you back around about $500, and there are cheaper options on the market as well. Now, number one on my list is a carbine. An AR-15 or M4 chambered in either the .223 or NATO 5.56 is one of America's most common and powerful semi-automatic rifles. They serve a variety of purposes for preppers, including self-defense and hunting, and they're extremely accurate up to about 300 meters, which is farther than you can even ID a target, unless it was obviously shooting at you. You can also reach out to 500 meters with a little training and 3x magnification. These firearms are easy to learn how to operate and have very minimum recoil, making it easy to stay on target firing multiple rounds, allowing faster follow-up shots with user fatigue being reduced. Now, the M16 is a military version of this rifle, and they've been issued to US soldiers since Vietnam, and they've evolved over the years to a very refined and accurate platform. The advantage of a carbine is that you can put a lot of rounds downrange very quickly, and reloading can be done very quickly as well with the right training. They're quite the force multiplier. Like the Glock 19 mentioned above, the AR-15 is a common firearm in the United States, and as a result, it's easy to get parts, accessories, and ammunitions. In a situation where gun parts may become limited or scarce, it's very likely you'll be able to find gun parts for AR-15 platform, which to me is a huge bonus. Also, finding good training on this platform is easy with thousands of experienced veterans returning home and opening firearm training companies. The prices on these can range as low as the mid 500s up to several thousands of dollars. A solid entry level AR-15 is the Smith & Wesson MP15 Sport, which will set you back about $750. Now, a very popular alternative is, of course, the AK-47. This option is extremely popular with preppers because they're renowned for their reliability even when neglected. Again, that's just one of those kind of personal preference things. All my training has been on the AR-15, and that's where I've put a lot of time in, spending a lot of time at the range with these things. But AK-47s, if you know what you're doing, they're pretty amazing weapons. So definitely look at that option if you're interested. Now, in my search for some cheap alternatives, the High Point 4095 carbine, which is a semi-automatic 40 cal, that one came up a lot. I saw a lot of those online. I'll provide a link in the description below if you want to look at some of those options. But again, remember, cheaper is not always better. So here are some additional thoughts. Firearms should not take top priority in your preps. I mean, the reality is they're just a tool like any other thing that you need to buy whenever you're beginning to get into prepping. A lot of times I see this in the prepper community, and there's almost an obsession at times with firearms and prioritizing them over things like food and water and, you know, medical supplies. You can begin to spend unbelievable amounts of money on firearms and ammunition. There are many other things when it comes to firearms that you need to prioritize. Start with getting one or two firearms and then focus on things like food, water, and medical gear. And once you have all these other priorities in place, swing back later when you have more money and build up an armory. And I cannot stress this enough, but get training. I've done training and it makes all the difference. And I'll provide a link in the description below to our sponsor, Range 6, which offers firearm training. If you're in the Salt Lake City area, check them out. Be sure to tell them City Prepping sent you. If you're not able to afford training from a professional, which again, I highly, highly recommend, there are other alternatives. One of my favorite training videos I review periodically is the Magpul Dynamics Art of the Tactical Carbine. It's a great step-by-step tutorial outlining the mechanics of the standard AR-15, which I'll provide a link to in the description below. I hope this video gave you some things to consider whenever you're looking at different firearms that are on the market. There's a lot of them out there, and again, these ones that I've listed are all run through the filter of the things that we talked about at the beginning of the video. But again, go out there, try them out, see what works for you, and hopefully you'll find the right one. So, as always, be safe out there. There may come a time when you or your family need to move unnoticed through a crowd, potentially during a time of civil unrest, in order to get to a bug-out location or get home. Would you know how to blend in so as not to draw attention to yourself? Could you be invisible? Could you be the gray man? You can show your support by clicking the like button below, subscribing to our channel, visiting our website, or providing feedback in the comments. In addition, I'll provide links to additional resources in the description section below. Enjoy the video. What is a gray man? The concept of the gray man can be boiled down to this: being able to blend in and not standing out. It's a way to fade into the background of whatever environment you're in, such that you do not elicit a response from those around you. It's being so bland that no one even remembers having seen you. In the context of prepping, the gray man concept is very useful in situations where you have to be mobile while staying undetected. By doing so, you become less of a target for those looking to take advantage of someone. So to begin with, why is being a gray man important? After a major catastrophic event, if there is a prolonged grid down scenario in your area, eventually people will become desperate. If you stand out as someone that has something of value, you will become a target. In this video, we'll discuss the wider applications in the context of a post-SHTF scenario, and we'll discuss the three rules to become a gray man. So let's jump in. Rule number one, determine your baseline. So what is a baseline? In the context of this conversation, a baseline is determining what is normal for behavior and appearance for a given environment. For example, if I were at the beach, I'd expect people to be wearing swim trunks, t-shirts, bathing suits, and would expect someone to be relaxing. Whereas if I were in a boardroom meeting with C-level executives, I would expect formal dress attire like suits, and I would expect people to be acting in a professional, business-like manner. Not only is clothing part of the baseline, but how people are acting, moving, and behaving is important as well. So a baseline is a combination of many things that revolve around one single concept. What is normal for the given environment in regards to how people appear, move, talk, and act? So how do you determine the baseline in a new environment? Simple, watch and observe. Before you head into a new environment, take a moment to look around to find out how people are dressing, acting, and behaving, and find a way to do the same. Your goal is to avoid acting or looking out of the norm. When it comes to the concept of the gray man, the goal is to avoid drawing attention to yourself, which leads us to the next point. Rule number two, avoid creating stimulus. A stimulus is anything that triggers a response when someone sees you that may form an impression with them. What do I mean? If you're in a crowd and you have something on your person or act in a way that causes someone to take notice, you've just created a stimulus. You have stimulated that person's mind to take note of something about you that was out of the ordinary. On a biological level, how does this happen? Without going into a deep discussion, I'll briefly run through how your brain processes and filters information. Let me introduce you to a part of your brain called the RAS, or Reticular Activating System. The RAS is the portal through which nearly all information enters the brain. It is a brain system that filters out extraneous information. You are bombarded on a daily basis by a lot of stimuli, and if your brain didn't filter out things that it deemed as unimportant, you'd suffer from sensory overload. Let me give you an example that you've probably experienced. Ever been at a party or a social event, engaged in a conversation with someone, surrounded by a lot of people or other people that are talking, and someone across the room mentions your name? That triggers a response in your brain. The RAS decided to not ignore this information and instead alerted you. The person didn't even have to yell your name, but nonetheless, your brain immediately takes note of this. Your brain this whole time has been filtering out the noise in the room, but prompted you to something that is important. In the context of this discussion regarding prepping, think about what you're wearing or doing that could be perceived as out of the norm that could trigger someone's attention. Going back to our discussion regarding the baseline, we don't want anything about our appearance such that someone looking at a crowd would notice something that stands out on our person. The moment we have created a stimuli in someone's mind, their attention is now on us. During a time of civil unrest, you don't want to draw attention to yourself. If you're trying to move through a crowd or in a neighborhood, you need to look normal, like you belong there. So how do we avoid creating stimulus? How do we match the baseline? Rule number three. Blend in. Now that we have established a foundation regarding a baseline and how stimulus is created, let's chat about four things you have control over to help you blend in and become a gray man. Number one, how you dress. To begin with, you want to wear clothing that is normal for your baseline. What are the people around you wearing? What is normal? In some parts of the country, wearing camouflage in public would be considered normal, whereas in other parts of the country, you're going to stick out like a turd in a punch bowl. Consider logos on your clothing. Wearing a shirt with a logo will probably trigger stimulus in someone's mind, whereas wearing a simple t-shirt with a muted color and no logos or markings probably wouldn't trigger anyone's attention. Again, remember from our previous discussion regarding the RAS, bland white noise is just filtered out of the mind, whereas markings or identifiers on your person will grab people's attention that could cause them to take note of you because they immediately identify something about you. I'll give you an example. I have a hat that I used to wear with an American flag morale patch. I was at a friend's party and a guy walked up and immediately struck up a conversation, and we were discussing firearms and local ranges we like to visit within a couple of minutes. I don't encounter a lot of these type of conversations here in Southern California, and in the course of the conversation, he pointed out that the hat was a dead giveaway. When wearing it, I often get asked if I'm in the military. The hat, which I like a lot, is probably best to be worn when I go to the range and I don't wear it anymore in public. Why? The hat causes an immediate stimulus with people and I've made an impression in their mind. In a hostile situation, someone may perceive me as a threat and target me first. The issue about becoming a gray man really isn't about wearing tactical looking clothing, but rather blending in with what other people are wearing around you. If you're not wanting to draw attention to yourself, avoid clothing that is not the baseline that could cause a stimulus in someone's mind. Number two, eye contact. Avoid this if at all possible. Once you make eye contact with someone, you will instantly trigger a stimulus in that person's mind. You ever been to the mall and walked by a kiosk where someone is trying to sell something? What are they trying to do? They're trying to get your attention to come buy their product. The moment you make eye contact, they will try to draw you in. When walking by, I tend to keep my eyes focused forward so that this connection is not made. In a grid down scenario, having eye contact gives someone a reason to engage with you. In addition to eye contact, avoid getting into conversations when possible. This is a worst case, as a conversation will form a lot of impressions in someone's mind about you. Number three, demeanor. Do not appear threatening. Even though you may be carrying a concealed weapon, the last thing you would want is to draw someone into an engagement, and by having a casual, calm look, you lessen your chance that someone may notice you. When observing your surroundings, be casual about it. Instead of making it obvious by moving your head and eyes while scanning the room, instead use a prop like reading a newspaper or looking at your phone so that you can use your peripheral vision. Number four, smell. For those that enjoy hunting, you know this principle all too well. If you're upwind and have a strong smell, the animals will pick up on this and leave. You've created a stimulus that triggers that animal that there's a threat. Something isn't quite right. In the context of our conversation, a smell can make an impression that someone will take note of you. So, what are the applications of the gray man in a pre-SHTF scenario? As I've pointed out in many of my videos, the less information you give your neighbors in regards to your preps, the better. Whether you're dressed with clothing that screams tactical or you share your political views with neighbors, they begin to obviously gather information about what you share and you are making an impression. Being a gray man with your neighbors doesn't necessarily mean they never notice you, but rather don't provide stimulus that tips them off that you are probably someone with preps. If things go sideways or there's catastrophe in your area, they'll remember you're the guy with the tactical looking clothing, loads guns into his car to go to the range, and has the NRA sticker on his cars. You're the guy that might have the gear and supplies they need for survival. I purposefully don't have any stickers on my cars for this very reason. I don't want to trigger a stimulus in someone's mind. I just want to be another neighbor. Remember what they say about first impressions? People will always remember that first impression. In our case, we don't want to make any impressions, we just want to blend into the white noise in the background. Just because you're trying to blend in and look like you're not a threat, this doesn't mean that you do not have the tools and skills necessary to defend yourself or your family if it comes down to it. You just look like it. Keep sharp. While you may look like you're lost in your thoughts, internally, you are analyzing what is going on around you, and you're on point in your mind. While you may be forgettable, you are not to be trifled with. You are the gray man. Thanks for watching this video, and as always, be safe out there. Hey YouTube, this is City Prepping. If things go sideways in a really bad way, and I'm talking about the kind of bad that a region or country doesn't quickly or ever bounce back from, more than likely you and your family will die if you're not prepared. Are you prepared enough to ensure your family can weather a major catastrophe? You can show your support for this channel by liking, commenting, or sharing this video on social media. In addition, I'll provide links to products I discuss in the description below. Enjoy the video! I tend to try and be as optimistic as I can when I consider possibilities involving an SHTF scenario. I consider myself to be a practical, pragmatic prepper of sorts, and I tend to focus on the most probable of disaster scenarios that I'll probably face in my area, like fires or earthquakes. I'd like to believe that most catastrophic problems in my region can be resolved within 2 to 4 weeks, assuming help comes. But I know as a prepper, it'd be foolish to not consider the possibility that things may not bounce back or help may never arrive. If this were to happen, would I be ready to take care of myself and my family? Many experts predict that if the power grid were to go down in the United States, by the end of the first month, one half of all Americans would die. Can you live 30 days without power, water, or food being available to you? In this video, we'll discuss the 10 most common ways people will die in the first month if there were an extended catastrophe. While this topic could be perceived as discouraging, the good news is we'll present solutions to ensure you and your family will be prepared to face those challenges. So let's jump into this discussion. Number one, the lack of water or even safe water to drink. I put this intentionally first, as you can only live 3 days without water. The biggest killer at the beginning of a catastrophe will be people dying from either a lack of water or the inability to gain access to sanitary water. If you've ever watched the news after a major catastrophe hits an area, you'll see that lethal diseases will quickly run rampant through individuals that have been displaced. The lack of sanitary water leads to diarrhea and other problems that can quickly kill people due to pathogens contaminating the water supply due to unsanitary conditions. How do you protect against this? Having gravity-fed water filtration or other water filtration systems that do not require power to operate will allow you to make your water safe. In my family's bug-out bags, I have a few different water filters: a Sawyer water filter, a Life Straw, and a PureSip personal water filter. While these small filters are good for handling bacteria, they're not really equipped to handle contaminants in water. In our home, we have a Berkey water filter as well, which we use on a daily basis. These filters can make contaminated water safe to drink. If you do not have water stored and a way to filter water, you need to focus on this first. In addition, have bleach or pool shock to kill viruses if your filter doesn't filter at this level. Number two, starving to death. The average person can only last 21 days without food. Most Americans have only enough food for a few days, as they're used to visiting the grocery store every few days. If a catastrophe prevents food deliveries to your local grocery store, which typically carries enough supplies for 3 days, then what? Malnutrition, food poisoning, and starvation will wipe out a large percentage of individuals in the first 30 days. This problem can be easily remedied by building a short-term food plan. In my home, I've stocked up on foods that we already use on a daily basis. We pull the food from this inventory as we need it. Things like spaghetti, rice, honey, beans, coffee, canned meats, canned food, etc. This is by no means a long-term food storage plan, which we'll cover in a future video, but rather this is food that is already used in our daily life. Here's what I did. We started setting aside a little extra money in our budget each month to grab additional food we already used and added it to our inventory. When we pull the food from our extra inventory supply, we have a clipboard in our storage area where we write down what was taken, and on our next trip, we simply replace that food. Remember, begin stocking staple foods that are easy to store and prepare and have a balance of fat, carbs, and proteins. Number three, your medication runs out. This is a bit of a challenge as you can't necessarily stock up on medications if your doctor only gives you enough of a supply until your next appointment. After a catastrophe hits an area, you can expect people will make a run on their local pharmacy to secure the drugs they need to survive. In addition, you need to consider the effect it will have in your local area when people come off their medication. Many people rely upon medication to not only deal with health issues, but also to keep them mentally stable. Without their meds, there could be severe side effects. People will get desperate and potentially dangerous. Without the medications, they won't last long. If your health condition can be managed with changes in your lifestyle, for example, getting in shape and losing weight, you need to give serious consideration to this, which leads us to our next point. Number four, people will die because they're out of shape. A few months ago, I had a tree in my backyard which began dying, and it was time to cut it down. And I don't own a chainsaw, so I had to use an axe to cut it down. Growing up, we would cut trees down all the time on our property and split wood, but that was back when I was 18 years old. Now that I'm 40 years old, that same task is much more difficult. Cutting down a tree was a bit of a challenge. While I typically spend about 3 days in the gym and I try to do cardio activities on other days, when cutting the tree down, I began to realize I was no longer a spring chicken. I was winded quickly and I found myself wishing I had a chainsaw. I got sloppy as well due to getting tired and nearly injuring myself when I tried to cut on the tree at an angle and nearly caused the axe blade to bounce into my leg, which I'll talk about in the next point. But the fact that I've been keeping myself in decent shape made the job possible. In a grid down situation where things are not bouncing back, you'll probably be required to perform physical activities to survive. Please don't underestimate this point as something you can put off. You have the opportunity to get your body in shape. Also consider things like how much extra weight you are currently carrying on your body. Being obese can be a huge liability in a grid down situation. With a modification to your diet, getting off your behind and doing a little moving on a daily basis, you can steer yourself in the right direction. There may come a time when my family relies upon me to do physical labor in order to survive, and I don't want to be unable to do it because I'd simply allowed my body to atrophy. Number five, individuals will die due to trauma, small injuries, or simply getting sick. As I mentioned earlier while chopping down the tree, I nearly had the axe blade slam into my leg. While it's easy to laugh this off as someone not being safe, think about how many people get injured performing a lot of physical activities that carry the risk of injury. Not only will major trauma potentially injure individuals, but think about how many minor injuries can lead to a severe infection. If you've ever had a small cut that has turned into an infection that needed attention, you could simply visit your physician to get the proper medications to treat the problem. Now, imagine individuals getting small cuts and nicks that they neglected, only having it turn out to be something worse and no one can get help. Not only do injuries carry a large risk of death, but getting sick can as well. So what can you do? Begin gaining medical knowledge and the proper medical supplies now. At a minimum, have a book in your inventory like the Survival Medicine Handbook, which I'll also include in the description below. Number six, a lack of sanitation. In the previous point, I pointed out that individuals getting sick can result in death without medical attention. If things go bad in your area, proper sanitation will be critical. Have you considered how you will dispose of the waste your family produces? And by waste, I'm referring to your urine and excrement in addition to leftover food or dirty dishes or other rubbish. We're so used to simply flushing our toilets and taking the trash out to the curb and the problem's gone. But what happens when the sewage stops working and the trash man doesn't come to pick up your trash? Then what? A lack of sanitation can lead to illness, which can spread through your home and kill your family. I would encourage you to begin researching options to dispose of your waste. Essential things like washing your hands thoroughly will be more important than ever. Have a decent supply of hand sanitizer. This will also be very helpful. Not only can getting sick be a problem in your family, but consider the damage it can do to morale having sick family members or being sick yourself. Number seven, many people envision the looters they'll have to face be gangs or some type of people displaced coming to take their supplies. While marauders like this could be potentially a big threat, the reality is you may have neighbors or other family members which can turn on you if you've prepared and they haven't. Now, when I first got serious about prepping, I thought sharing my excitement about prepping with friends and family would excite them to get serious about prepping as well. It pretty much had the opposite effect. They looked at me strangely, and later they brought up that if things were to go bad, they'd come to my house immediately to seek help. Remember earlier we mentioned that only about 1% of Americans are quote-unquote preppers. Well, what do you think the other 99% of Americans are going to do when they can't find food or water? Thinking about this does concern me greatly because I never want to harm someone if they were hungry or coming for my stuff, especially if they were someone I knew and loved. And by coming for my stuff, I don't mean just asking or pleading. When people get desperate, they will do anything it takes to survive. If you only have enough supplies to keep your family alive, what will you do if that neighbor that has it prepared goes past demanding help and decides that they will take from you even if they have to hurt you or your family? So what are we to do here? If gangs or looters are bent on hurting you for what you have, then the answer is kind of obvious. But what are we to do regarding friends or family? This is a moral dilemma that goes in my head a lot, and I see it often discussed in the prepping community as well. If you want to open your supplies to help others, remember you are lessening the probability your family will live that much longer and the probability those people will come back to keep asking for more and more help. In my mind, there's only three answers, which I'll discuss quickly. And please, by all means, if you have another view on this or better ideas, please share in the comments section below. Number one, keep your mouth shut. The less information you provide to others about what you have, the better. Number two, help others now and educate them. While this may seem to be the exact opposite piece of advice I just gave you in point one, you don't have to disclose all your preps and show off everything you have to them. Just help educate them that they should prepare. Remember, the less desperate they are, the less of a threat they are to you, and the more they can help you. Number three, arm yourself. If it comes down to it, you may be forced to protect your family. While I have no desire to harm anyone, if it comes down to me and my family and a person bent on hurting us, I'll do whatever it takes. And on a side note, I don't advocate violence on this channel, and I greatly value human life. Remember, if you harm or kill someone, you will ultimately be held accountable for your actions. But when the social niceties that we enjoy in our society go out the window when people get desperate and they pose a threat to me or my family, I won't hesitate for a moment to do whatever it takes to stop them. Number eight, you aren't prepared for reality. So your plan is if things hit the fan, you're gonna grab that awesome bug out bag and you're gonna run to the mountains and live off the land. In your mind, you dream of picking berries, drinking from streams, trapping rabbits, or hunting deer. You'll live in a tent with your family and survive in that national forest near you. Okay, so I don't have time in this video to break this entire fantasy down, but good luck with that. The reality is that all that cool gear that you bought, the 500 rounds of ammo you're storing up, the seeds you purchase online to build a big crop that you've never even planted, those things aren't gonna save you. If you've got a family, think you can just run into the mountains and live off the land indefinitely? If you're not practicing this lifestyle now, you're probably not gonna suddenly transition overnight to this and suddenly thrive or even survive. So what am I saying here? Live in reality on this issue. The fantasy of becoming some amazing survivalist with several family members in tow isn't going to last very long. I live in a suburban environment, and I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that my suburban home will not support my family long term. I know we can definitely survive for at least 30 days, maybe even 60, if we're able to bug in and don't have any major conflicts, as I mentioned in the previous point. So what can you do? My biggest piece of advice at this point is network. Build relationships with other like-minded preppers and people that are preparing like you. I've been fortunate to find a solid network in my area. In the past, I've used the website meetup.com to find a local prepper group in my area. You'll definitely meet some oddballs, but overall, I've been able to meet some really solid people. While it's beyond the scope of this video, the lone wolf mentality will only get you so far. Live in reality and take an honest assessment of what you and your family can do, and do yourself a favor and connect with other preppers that can help you where you are deficient. Number nine, you'll freeze to death. I'm fortunate to live in the part of the United States that doesn't get terribly cold during the winter, but in many parts of the United States, temperatures can drop to very dangerous levels that can kill. So what will you do? Are you going to start that fireplace that you've never used before? Okay, do you have firewood already cut and prepared? If not, do you have the tools to do so, and do you have places around you to go and cut down firewood? For many that cannot get a fuel source in time before the temperature drops to dangerous levels, they'll try burning things that they shouldn't, and they'll stand the possibility of carbon monoxide poisoning or possibly burning down their own home. If you have a fireplace, start by making sure the chimney's cleaned out and have firewood on hand that is already cut up. Find methods that others use in your area to heat their home that is not dependent on the electrical grid functioning. Each region is unique and different in how they handle heating homes, and be sure to have a backup plan should the power go off. And number 10, you give up. Last but not least, many people will simply give up. Some will simply lose the will to move forward or to keep fighting. Things may not go according to plans, bad things may happen, your supplies may get looted, someone in your home may die. The list of what could happen can go on and on. The key is this: do not give up. especially if you have a family or others depending on you. You may have to dig deep inside to find the strength and fortitude that come hell or high water, you will not back down or give up. If you have dependents, giving up is not an option. Remember this, a negative, defeated attitude can be like cancer and spread to others around you. As we discussed earlier, morale in times like this is critical. This goes beyond just having the right tools or supplies. If you are prepping now for yourself and your family, remember that they will be looking to you to not only lead in your preps, but in those dark moments when all hope seems lost. Don't give up. Determine now that you will dig in your heels and align your mind to that end. You may be the only beacon of hope others have. While making this video, it challenged me to reconsider a few things I need to focus on a little more, and I hope it will do the same for you. Again, please feel free to provide your feedback in the comments section below. As always, be safe out there. Hey YouTube, this is City Prepping, and in this video I want to talk about what is probably the most important and most critical prep that you can start with if you get into emergency preparedness and prepping. What we're going to be talking about today is water and water storage. It's easy to set up, store, and forget about water. You can pretty much just put it away somewhere and you're good to go. You can get enough water to last a family of four for about 3 to 4 weeks with all the containers, preservatives, etc., probably for under $250. And it's easy to get focused on gear and gadgets when you first get into prepping, but water is really the first thing that you should be concerned about and really focus on when you start prepping. So in this video, we're going to discuss a few different things here. Number one, the importance of water. Number two, the type of storage containers available on the market. Number three, where to store your water. Number four, how to prepare your storage containers and water for long-term storage. How much water should you store? Places you can find water in a situation where the infrastructure in your area has been damaged, and making water safe to drink. So the first subject matter is the importance of water. You can't live longer than 3 days without water. Food, you can go, you know, roughly 3 weeks or so, but water is not going to happen. Your body depends on it. And after a certain period of time, it will start shutting down if it doesn't get it. On the other hand, just taking in water itself is not the solution. You've got to have good, clean, sanitary water, because ingesting unsanitary water with pathogens can result in severe illness, resulting in death. If we look at the recent situation that's been happening in Flint, Michigan, you can just see how much damage it does to a community when clean, fresh water is not available. That community is going through a lot of challenges simply because they don't have clean water. So many things that we do on a daily basis, they require water, whether it's drinking, cooking, cleaning, bathing, even using the toilet. If the water was not available and not coming out of the tap, should there be an emergency or catastrophe in your area, what would you do when it comes to water? The average American, they use 80 to 100 gallons of water a day. And in a grid down scenario, you can get by on about 1 gallon of water per day per person in your household. There's even websites like ready.gov that recommend you have at a bare minimum 3 days of water on hand per person. I was watching TV the other day a few weeks ago, and on Conan O'Brien, they even had a whole segment about preparing for an emergency. And when Conan O'Brien asked the guests on the show what people should be doing to prepare, her advice was store up a lot of water. And I'll provide a link to that episode in the description below. It's really important that you, if you're going to get into prepping and emergency preparedness, that you first focus on water. Because again, that is hands down, apart from your shelter, that's going to be one of the most important things you'll need. So the next question becomes, well, what can I store water in? What do I use? Well, most of us will, in the prepping community, and you'll see this a lot of times, you'll see people using different type of polymer plastic storage containers. And what you're going to look for is on the bottom, you'll see a little stamp. It will say PETE or PET. And these are the type of grade of plastic that's safe for drinking out of. Now, I have several different types of storage containers in my home. I've got 5 gallon stackable plastic containers. These are like a dark blue, and I'll provide a link in the description below. I've also got 7 gallon non-stackable water containers, and these are also really great, these 5 gallon and 7 gallon. I've got them in different places. The 5 gallons, obviously, I try to stack them where I can. The 7 gallons, I slide them into areas that are, I can't necessarily stack them. But these are both great options, especially when it comes to being in a bug out situation where you have to leave them quickly. because the next item we'll talk about is a 55-gallon water storage container. And I've got several of these in my garage. But in an emergency, you can't really move those around. You can't throw in the back of your truck and head out of town. With a 5-gallon and 7-gallon, you can, so I keep a lot of those on hand as well. When it comes to 55-gallon water containers, you'll hear a lot of myths online about don't store it on cement. You know, basically, from what I've read, you don't want to store it on hot cement. I put 2x4s under my 55-gallon water storage containers. I just don't want them resting on the ground. Maybe I bought into the myth. So I'll provide a link to, you know, different websites where you can pick up these 55-gallon storage containers. You know, these, I keep these in the garage. I would love to keep them in the house, and I'll talk about where to store them here in a second. You're going to need, when you pick up one of these 55-gallon, you're going to need a bung wrench to open up the, you know, the cap on the top of the storage container, and you're going to need a water pump to extract the water out. And one of the things that I definitely recommend before you store your water containers, make sure you put a date on them and put any relevant information. For example, on mine, you know, I put the date when I originally stored them, prepped them, put water preservative in them, and explain how long the water preservative is good for. So that way I can always go back and look, and I can know when I have to rotate them next. The next question becomes, where do you store your water container? The most important thing is to store it out of sunlight. Sunlight encourages bacterial growth in your water. And ideally, you want to store it in a cool, dry place, around 50 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. Most of my water I keep under our stairwell and our closet. It's a really cool place. It never really gets hot there. And I store them in different places in our house, in closets. And again, I make sure I cover them up. I also store my 55-gallon in the garage. It's not the ideal place because it can get really hot in the garage, and it's not a place that's going to be cool. But unfortunately, I don't have the space in my house, and you may run into the same issue. If I have the option, I would store them in the house, but I don't have the option. If you do store them outside, make sure you cover them up with a tarp or something that will keep the sunlight off of them. The next question is, how do you prepare your storage containers and water for long-term storage? First of all, if you're going to use water containers, make sure you purchase some that have not been used. In other words, get them brand new. Those are the ones that you're going to want to ultimately use for your drinking water. Now, you can find great deals if you go on Craigslist or other websites or garage sales. You'll find a lot of times used water containers, 55-gallon, etc. And I picked up a few of those in the past for really good deals. The ones that are used that I don't know the history on them, I don't put our drinking water in that water that I'm going to rely upon. That in the situation where we, you know, need drinking water, I wouldn't want to rely on those. I use those for, you know, in the event of emergency, you're going to need water for, again, basic sanitation things like washing your hands, taking a bath, flushing, you know, flushing your toilet, you know, maybe even doing the dishes. But those are things that I don't want to actually take in and, you know, drink. Whenever I have two 55-gallon water drums that, again, I picked up at a garage sale, and I got a great deal on them. And again, I just use those for basic sanitation needs. And in both of those, I've added about a fourth cup of unscented bleach into those. So before you use even water containers that are brand new, you're going to want to make sure you sterilize them by throwing in some bleach and water on the inside and, you know, swishing it around really good and making sure all the surfaces get contact. Again, just a basic combination of unscented bleach and water. The one thing that I've done in all the water that I'm going to use for drinking is I've added water preservative. I'll provide a link in the description below. A lot of times people say, hey, you know, if the water comes out of the tap, it's already treated with chlorine, so you'll be safe. I just choose to add water preservative into all my water containers. It's not that expensive. You can pick up water preservative on Amazon for less than $10, and it'll treat up to 55 gallons of water. So that's just what I choose to use. Again, I think it's kind of a cheap insurance policy than rather assuming that the chlorine that's in the, you know, water in our tap will take care of it and keep the water preserved for a long period of time. So whenever you're done filling these containers up, after you've cleaned them out really well, you want to cap them off so no contaminants or air get inside. And again, I'll provide a link in the description below to the CDC website where they talk about prepping water containers. It has a lot of great information there. The next question that often comes up is, how much water should you store? What I always encourage people to do is just at least at a bare minimum have a 3-day water supply in your house for everybody. So yeah. I always encourage people at a bare minimum, you need at least a 3-day water supply on hand. And that's 3 days of water for each person. So if there's 4 people in your house for 3 days, that's 12 gallons. So you want to start there and then work up. I've at this point in the game, I'm up to about a month. Over the next year, I'm going to try to build that up to 2 or 3 months. I'm going to continue adding on different options. Starting out with 3 days can literally be done under $10. You can go to the grocery store and pick up the plastic, little like 2.5 gallon water containers for I think about $1, $1.50. Put that somewhere in a cool, dry place, and that's the first starting point right there. And again, they're in an emergency situation, those are easy to move around. And they also can be used on a daily basis. You may go to a picnic or something, and they're great to have. So think practically. Think of something that you can use. Once you start in the 3 days, then work up to 2 weeks, and then a month, and go from there. Places you can find water in a situation where the infrastructure in your area has been damaged. If, again, some type of catastrophe happens in your area, you can get water from the back of your toilet in the tank. That's assuming that you have it put any kind of cleaner or, anything like that in it. So that's, it's safe. I personally would probably boil it, but it's safe to drink. Hot water heater in your garage. Most people don't think about this, but it holds roughly 50 gallons. And a lot of times there's a little, just valve at the bottom you can open up and get the water out of. Pipes in the house. I live in a two-story house, so whenever we drain the water, obviously the pipes upstairs, they go first, then you turn the ones downstairs and, they empty out. And you can even get, the water will store at the very, very bottom of the pipe. So there's ways you can extract and get those out, the water out of the pipes. Having a rain catchment system is something I currently don't have, but I plan on building down the road, and that's a really good option. And one that's a lot of times people bring up is a pool. Sometimes people may argue, well, I have a pool, so do I really need to store water? Yeah, you do. You're assuming that that water in an emergency doesn't get contaminated. What if there's radiation fallout? What if, you could go down the list of what ifs. It's sitting out in the open. It can easily get contaminated. So a pool would be my last options. If I had no other option, even then I'm going to have to really boil it, treat it, probably filter it, and let's talk about that point next. The next point is, how do you make water safe to drink? And we'll talk about boiling, treating, and filtering. The first one is boiling. Bringing water to a rolling boil for about 3 to 5 minutes, it's going to kill most of the waterborne microorganisms. However, just because you boil it, it's not going to necessarily take out toxic contaminants. Also remember that whenever you boil, that means you have to use fuel. Fuel is valuable in a time of an emergency. Fuel, if you don't have it on hand, by fuel I mean whether it's propane or you've collected wood to burn, even the time that it takes to split wood and to bring wood back to your house, that is time, that's fuel. That's fuel that your body, that's calories that, you're beginning to use. So whenever we talk about water storage, we want to have it ready to use in a time of emergency, not pull it out and then have to treat it. That's the last, that's not at the time that you want to have to begin to treat your water. The next item is bleach. You can use bleach to kill most of the microorganisms. You can add about 8 drops of fresh liquid household chlorine bleach to every about 4 liters, or in other words, 1 gallon of water, and that will kill most organisms. It's going to still be safe for you to drink. Probably let it sit for 30 minutes to an hour or so. That's only household bleach that doesn't have thickeners, scents, or additives. Don't use all the bleaches that have all those. You want a non-scented bleach. And again, bleach, just like boiling, doesn't necessarily address the issue of toxic contamination. Now, this is where filters come in. You're going to want to have filters on hand to address any toxic contamination. In my different bug out bags, vehicle, EDCs, etc., I've got 3 different types of water filters. I've got a Life Straw, I've got a Sawyer water filter, and I've got a Pure Sip water filter. Again, these are real simple, kind of on your person. They're not going to filter a whole lot of water and a lot of the heavy contaminants. So, they'll get you by in a pinch, but if you're in a long-term situation, obviously that's not going to filter out water for, like cooking or other things that you're going to need eventually do. But they're good to have on hand nonetheless, and I'll provide links in the description below to some of the ones I use. Now, on the issue of filtering, I've really researched this for a while, and you're more than welcome to do it yourself. You may come to a different conclusion, but I've found so many different filters that you can pick up on the market. Some are better than others, and some are cheap, but at the end of the day, if my life's on the line, I'm not looking for cheap. The one that consistently stands out that's, seems to be the most popular and really gets the job done, is the Berkey water filters. They're expensive as all get out, but the beauty of something like that is you can use them in everyday life. It's not just you have to pull it out of the closet, pay $100 for a filter, and then never use it, you know, or maybe use it once in 10 years. I just like the fact that I can actually, when I think about prepping, I can use things in a practical everyday context, and a Berkey water filter is awesome for that. And, you know, apart from all the, you know, things that it can do to clean your water up just for your family, it's my recommendation, and it's what we use in our home. And again, I'll provide a link in the description below. So the final note about water preparation, remember, two is one and one is none. Always, always have backup options. When it comes to water, I have, you know, I'm going to continue to build and expand upon my water storage, because where I live, it's for all intents and purposes, it's a desert. And I just want to make sure that we are prepared, you know, should we have an earthquake or some other catastrophe that could take down the, you know, the water system here. As always, I'll provide links in the description below to the different websites and products that I talked about in this video that I use personally. As always, if you find these videos useful, please click on the subscribe button below. And I always find it interesting the different comments that people post on my videos. Some of the great information they provided that I never would have thought about. I'm learning like everyone else, and I always enjoy to hear your feedback. As always, be safe out there.
If a major catastrophe hits your area, your local grocery store will have about 3 days' worth of food on hand before their inventory is depleted. Would you have enough food in your home to make sure you and your family could eat if help doesn't arrive right away?
You can show your support for this channel by clicking the like button, sharing on social media, providing feedback in the comment section, and don't forget as a subscriber to click the bell icon below to get updates. Enjoy the video.
FEMA recommends at a minimum a 3-day food supply to support you and your family after a major catastrophe. But the reality is that after a major disaster, it could take much longer before food and water supplies make it to the general population. In this video, we'll discuss simple items that you're probably already using on a daily basis that you could begin to stock up on now. The great thing about these items we're discussing is that they're items that you use anyway, and by purchasing extra, they'll get used eventually, so you're not getting items that are going to go to waste. The long-term goal is to have food storage well beyond 2 weeks, but by having at least 2 weeks of food stored up, you're probably ahead of 95% of the population. So I'll be breaking this video down into three parts. Number one, why I recommend these items. Number two, the items I recommend for your 2-week pantry. And number three, additional considerations and going beyond just 2 weeks. So let's jump in. So first, why do I recommend these items? Well, here's why I choose these items for my pantry. They had to be easy to cook. They need to be easy to store for a decent amount of time without refrigeration. I want items that are already part of our daily meals. I like food items that require little electricity or fuel to prepare, and they need to provide ample nutrition and contain little salt. Many times when people start out in prepping, the thought of long-term food storage can be intimidating, but if you're new to prepping, or even if you've been prepping for a while, this list will help you get kick-started toward a long-term food storage plan. And consider this list as a bare minimum starting point. In later videos, we'll get into discussing long-term food approaches, but this is just a good way to get started. So here's the items in my list. Obviously, change it in relation to the size of your family. For example, I have a family of four. We have 2 adults and 2 children who are 8 and 6. So I'm coming to these amounts based on what we typically eat on a daily basis. So here are the items in my list in no specific order. Number one, rice. Typically, you'll have the option of either brown or white rice. Either one will work fine. I prefer brown for its nutritional value, and I would recommend probably around 20 pounds. The second item in my list is beans. There's a whole lot of options based on your taste. We personally stock up on canned black beans, which we use anyway in our daily routine. I'd recommend about 20 pounds of dried beans if you're going to go to the dry beans route of something like pinto beans. Now, rice is rich in starch, and it's an excellent source of energy, while beans are rich in protein and contain other minerals. Now, these two items are staple foods around the world. Obviously, combined together, they're a great source of amino acids, and it's no wonder that many people use these for their part of their staple diet around the world. So these probably would be the first two that I would add to my list. Number three is canned meat. I went with chicken on this one. We're not a big fan of Spam or tuna in our house. And so, hey, you know, at the end of the day, everything tastes like chicken, right? So you can't go wrong with this. Again, start with about 20 cans of this. Number four on my list is canned fruit. Number five is canned vegetables. We went with green beans, corn, and tomatoes. And again, I'd recommend probably around just 20 cans or so of these. Number six on my list is soup. Again, I'm just kind of throwing 20 cans out. Usually for most of these items, it's just kind of an easy number. And soup's great because it's something that you can cook up really quickly with little to no preparation. Number seven is powdered milk. Milk can serve a lot of purposes. Mix it in with your oatmeal or add it to your coffee. It's nutritious and it's just a great comfort food all around. Number eight is cereal. Combine this with powdered milk and again, you've got an easy breakfast. Number nine is oatmeal. You can throw in some fruits, peanut butter, or powdered milk and you've got a solid breakfast. About 5 pounds of this should work. Number 10 is peanut butter. You can get a couple of large jars and you'll be set. Peanut butter is a really popular option in the prepper community as it's got, you know, high protein and it's packed with calories and it's something that will help you kind of keep hunger at bay whenever, after you eat it. Number 11 is pancake mix. I keep about 10 pounds of this in storage. You can toss some jam or syrup on this and you've got a great meal. Number 12. Honey, jam, or syrup. These are all great sweeteners for various food items we mentioned on this list. I keep a couple of jars of jams in storage along with about 10 pounds of honey and a couple of, you know, different syrup options. So just great kind of comfort food, so to speak. When things get bad, it's not a bad idea to have something around that's sweet. It's just, you know, kind of a psychological boost. Number 13, pasta. This is, again, something I keep around 20 pounds of in my storage. Again, there's a lot of different options. We always go with whole grain. Number 14, spaghetti sauce. This is something we keep around about 10 jars of in storage. You can throw some pasta and spaghetti together and you've got a great meal. Number 15 is salt. In addition to using it to enhance the flavor of your food, this is a necessary mineral that your body needs to operate. So, can't have enough of that. And obviously it's cheap. Number 16, oil. We keep olive oil and a few other options in our storage. Oil serves many purposes in cooking. And the great thing about it is that it helps to satiate hunger. Number 17, coffee and or tea. I know for me personally, if anything were to happen and I didn't have my coffee, yeah, I'd probably be in a world of hurt. Number 18, spices and condiments. These options, things like, you know, Tabasco sauce, oregano, salsa, pepper, other options, these just help add variety to your diet and just prevent, you know, fatigue of having to eat certain foods over and over. It's always nice, you know, spices kind of add a little variety and help mix things up some. Number 19, nuts. And this is an easy comfort food you can quickly grab again, source of protein, source of fat. Number 20, packaged meals, something like a macaroni and cheese. We added these to our inventory for our kids. Again, just some easy comfort foods we know they'll like, easy to cook and prepare. And here's an additional bonus item for your food storage, having a garden. Now, while this isn't a food storage item, obviously, it's great to have a backup option, you know, something that, number one, you have fresh food and something that can be replenished. I've done a few videos, or rather I did a video on this a few weeks ago, and I'll provide a link in the description below of how I started getting into raised bed gardening. I have no experience with gardening, and surprisingly, it's not that hard, and I'm already beginning to see a crop coming in, as I begin to plant different seeds over the last couple of months. So I encourage you to check that out. Also, here's some additional considerations. Before you start just, you know, going out and grabbing a bunch of things and adding it to your inventory, number one, make sure you have enough water stored up. I can't emphasize this enough. People often underestimate this, how much water they're gonna need. I've done a couple of videos in the past where I talked about, you know, water storage and purification. Obviously, the things that we're talking about on the list that you're cooking, they'll need water. So definitely have that stored up and prepared. Number two, actually buy food items that your family enjoys. When I made the list, I did a lot of research and I found a lot of different options that were really popular, but they didn't really work with what our family enjoys eating. So I just altered our diet, or rather altered this list based on what our family's diet is. And we stocked up on items that we already use. again, what we talked about earlier, don't get things that you're going to buy and you're never going to use them and you end up tossing them and throw them away. What's the point? So find items that you actually enjoy that you're already using and just add those in, stock up and add extra. Also, consider convenience foods that are easy to grab and eat and don't necessarily require a lot of preparation, like protein bars or crackers. And be sure to actually try these foods out before stocking them up. Again, you know, if there was a time of catastrophe and you're left eating some food that you don't even like to begin with, that's just not going to help. Number three, have a place to store food. You can clear out a closet in your house or find some other location that's not being used. Also, be sure to rotate your supplies. Check the expiration dates on the different cans or the different things you purchase and put the items with an expiration date that's further in the future at the back. And the items that need to be eaten sooner, move those toward the front. Be sure as well to have a pen and paper in the storage area to write down items you need to replace on your next trip to the store when you pull an item out of storage. Again, buy what you eat, rotate, and repeat. In a future video, I'll be creating a series of videos where I'll talk about setting up your prepper's kitchen, including sanitation and cleanup, as well as discuss several different fuel options to ensure you can cook your food. For those that want to go beyond just the basics discussed in this video and are serious about long-term food storage, which is again another video I'll be doing hopefully sometime soon, be sure to check out the Prepper's Cookbook, a book that I'm currently reading. If you enjoy this video, please be sure to like and share. In addition, if you'd like to help this channel, please check out my Amazon store, which I'll provide a link in the description below. And if you have any items on your food storage list that are not mentioned in the video, please feel free to share them in the comments section below, as I always enjoy to hear back from the community. And a lot of times these comments, I do read them and I get a lot of insight. And there's things that I may not have even considered, and it helps kind of, mature me and grow me as a prepper. So, as always, be safe out there.